National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, and doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, September 22nd, 1946, we present the 44th and final broadcast in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today...
Report to date.
Almost a year of peace has passed since the first broadcast of The National Hour.
Here at home and abroad, this was a year of the beginnings of reconstruction, reconversion, the first steps on the road of peace.
What progress have we made along the way, and how far have we traveled? What is to our credit and what to our debit as we strike
a balance for the first year of peace?
This is Robert St. John in New York. As we review the subjects treated on the National Hour this past year, it seems that never before have there been so many days so packed with clamor for decision, with questions to be weighed and answered, questions and decisions which will shape the lives of the 2 billion inhabitants of this earth. Today we shall recall to you some of the subjects which we treated this past year, and we shall bring the account up to date by detailing the further movements toward reconstruction and peace.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington, a city to which a peace-seeking world looks for answers and reassurance. To bring our year's statement up to the moment, we shall, in the course of this half hour, call upon John McVane of NBC and Edward Barrett of Newsweek magazine. We are standing by.
In the third week of November of last year, the National Hour presented program number one. The script was concerned with the problem which was first on the world's agenda for immediate action. The subject was...
Food.
Yes, food. Food, the feeding of ourselves and of a war-torn, weary world. Hunger stalks the world today, and where there is hunger, there is unrest, disease, death. In an Italian schoolroom, the children study the political climate of a new world.
And this type of government is called... Pietro, what is it called?
It is called democracy.
Good. And what does democracy mean?
Democracy means where the people rule. And it means that you don't have to be afraid. And...
Yes, go on.
And in a democracy, there is no hunger and... Oh, senor, excuse me. I have to sit down.
What is it, Pietro? Are you sick? Tell me, Pietro, did you eat this morning?
No, senor. There has been nothing since the day before yesterday.
In the countries of Europe and Asia, bread has become not only an item of nutrition, but an international weapon.
Certainly, we are interested in democracy, freedom, the concept of one world. But of what use is the right to vote if we are too hungry to care what we are voting for?
But what can we do?
Have we got enough to feed ourselves?
Have we enough to feed the world?
Has the world enough to feed the world?
Our investigations that November Sunday afternoon led to the following findings.
That there was a working international organization, the UNRWA, ready and equipped and financed to relieve suffering by relief and rehabilitation.
That the Secretary of Agriculture assured us that for all reasonable home requirements, our domestic food supply is more than ample.
10 months have passed since that broadcast, and these are the present facts which highlight the international and domestic food situations. UNRWA, organized on a temporary basis, is to cease its work in Europe on December the 31st, in the Far East next March. From then on, each nation in need will have to make its own deals for foodstuffs and for agricultural supplies. But these nations will be aided by the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN, a permanent expert advisory board which is concerning itself with immediate planning to meet emergency needs and long-range planning for stable food production and distribution.
In this country, we met our UNRWA quotas of wheat and corn, but meat, eggs, bread, flour, and wheat breakfast foods were scarce. Last week, the nation's butcher stores were empty and closed. The meat shortage threatened to last for several months, but the American people are still eating more and a greater variety of foods than any other people in the world.
In the weeks that followed broadcast number one, the National Hour turned its attention to the refugee problem, to the president's proposed national health bill, to the predictions of experts forecasting developments in the year 1946.
In January, the United Nations delegations met in London to settle upon the composition and functions of a General Assembly to sit as an international congress for the peace of the world. The National Hour drew the background for that London meeting, from the Atlantic Charter to the convocation of delegates from 51 nations in San Francisco in the spring of 45. There in San Francisco, a charter was adopted, a blueprint for the peace machinery of the world.
To indicate the nature of the deliberations in San Francisco, we sketch the following scene.
We are in the press gallery in the Veterans Building in San Francisco. Two reporters at their table are unaware that they are about to see history in the making.
Well, looks like all the fireworks are over, eh, Joe?
Yep, all sweetness and light. Haven't had a good story from the floor in 2 days.
I could certainly use a headline.
We both could. Hey, Imogen, Rummy?
Yeah, sure, okay. Hey, wait a minute.
Hmm? Who's that down there on the floor?
Let's have a look.
Mr. Chairman!
He's speaking.
Mr. Chairman! I request the privilege of the floor.
The chair recognizes Delegate Padilla of Mexico.
Mr. Chair, the Republic of Mexico wishes to suggest that certain nations, as at present constituted, be barred from membership in the United Nations organization. Is that suggestion in order?
Hey, this sounds hot, ain't he?
Yeah, you said it. I better get my paper on the phone.
You have the floor, Delegate Padilla. The chair is willing to listen to any suggestions by the Republic of Mexico.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, the Republic of Mexico feels very strongly that membership in the United Nations organization should not be granted to any nation sympathetic to the Axis or any government set up with the Axis.
Yeah, that's right.
Specifically, we in Latin America are against membership in the United Nations for the government of Spain. It is a well-known fact that the present Spanish government was set up with the help of Mussolini and Hitler. Speaking for my country, I wish to know if the members of this conference are in favor of admitting the government of Spain.
No.
I wish to know explicitly the position of the United States of America on this question.
The United States government is in complete accord with the sentiments expressed by the Republic of Mexico.
Yeah.
That was one conference action which got quick approval. But there were many motions. There were many arguments on these motions, many bitter word battles. And there have been many since in the meetings of the Security Council. For these are the birth pangs of peace.
And now the first official session of the General Assembly is to convene next month in its permanent headquarters in Flushing Meadows. Here is NBC's John McVane, who has been assigned to cover UN, as he outlines some of the problems this session will face as it begins the task of coordinating its work with the decisions of the Paris Peace Conference.
When the representatives of 51 nations meet in Flushing, their decisions will literally settle the kind of world in which we are to live. At this moment, the United Nations consists of a foundation and some scaffolding. Next month's assembly will begin to raise the walls. By the time the assembly finishes, we should have some idea of what the edifice will look like when it's complete. Until the assembly meets, almost everything about the United Nations is temporary and tentative. Even staff appointments are not permanent. Take the most important question of our age, atomic energy. Ideas are being tossed about freely in committee meetings, but nothing concrete and lasting can be done until the Paris Peace Conference, and especially the meetings of the Assembly, have blocked out the shape of the world in which atom control is to be exercised. The Security Council has been dealing with some troublesome problems, but its work has been handicapped by the fact that right now the Council knows it has no power against breaches of international peace and security. Will the Council have an effective international police force, as the Charter provides, to enforce international law? That is up to the Assembly. The nations must decide what they will contribute in men, arms, and money to such a police force. The committees have been sketching out ideas for an economic United States of Europe, most efficient use of power, transport, raw materials for the good of the world as a whole. But until the peace conference has decided what will be the future of the former Axis nations, and until the Assembly approves the ideas, they will remain just intellectual exercises. Trusteeships, development of backward areas, rehabilitation of territories devastated by war, the hundreds of thousands of displaced persons, these are problems only the Assembly can solve. At least one development in the Assembly is sure to be dramatic. A group of small nations, led by Australia, will challenge the veto power of the Big Five as based on the theory that might makes right. And if 46 nations oppose five on this point, it will be interesting to see what happens.
Then the National Hour took its listeners through an investigation of the possibilities and problems of the demobilized GI as a small businessman. We studied the nation's railroads, our maritime service, our lumber supply, and our oil resources, and also the black market in babies.
We dealt with housing.
Well, you sure got a chest full of ribbons there, son. That one, the Pacific ribbon?
That's right.
What about this one?
Presidential citation.
Well, 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 what do you know? Son, I guess this country owes you a great deal.
Yeah, strictly in times of war. After that, the hero is way down in the bargain basement.
Well, now, I wouldn't say that.
Wouldn't you? Look, mister, what do you think is going on right here in front of your nose?
Well, I guess you're moving into this house, huh? Your furniture's on the sidewalk and everything.
Guess again, mister. I'm moving out. I've just been dispossessed.
We reported that in November 1945, the federal government sent a special delivery letter to the mayors of many American cities. The letter said, in essence,
the housing situation in this country is no longer just a problem. It's a crisis, a major crisis.
From veterans and civilians in Cleveland, Chicago, Denver, Hollywood, San Francisco, the National Hour documented the crisis in housing. At the end of this national roundup of experiences, a woman asked,
well, what's the reason for it? I mean, why couldn't the government have done something about this when the shortage came up a few years ago?
Well, madam, as a matter of fact, the housing shortage did not come up a few years ago. It began more than a quarter of a century ago, way back in 1918, and it's grown worse ever since. During the years 1920 to 39, America built approximately 10 million dwelling units. But the number of families increased by 11 million. And Americans' families are still on the increase. So there are hundreds of thousands of families who have no place to live.
Well, then who's doing something about it? The government should be. But just what is the government doing about it?
That question was passed on to Robert McCormick in Washington, who reported...
Well, the government is not idle. The Wagner-Ellender-Taft bill is up in Congress this week. Patman of Texas introduced another housing bill last week for an overall government housing czar. And government agencies are working constantly. 1946 has been designated the year of challenge and work to meet the emergency in housing.
In the months that followed our broadcast, all building materials were placed under a system of priorities. Housing for veterans received top priority. Thousands of homes were built and sold under the loan provisions of the GI Bill of Rights. But the peak of emergency still rose. Quonset huts and barracks were reconverted to family needs, but the peak rose still higher. Building materials mysteriously vanished from legitimate sources of purchase, and 2 weeks ago the whole matter was highlighted by a feature article in the New York Times. The lead paragraph read,
"Skyrocketing prices for key home building materials in the black market have stymied private builders in their effort to meet pressing demands for housing in the metropolitan area and threaten to create a national scandal in the industry."
During these past few days, the editors of Newsweek magazine asked their correspondents over the nation to survey the building and housing scene. The current issue carries the report on that survey, and here to summarize it for us is Edward W. Barrett, editorial director of Newsweek.
The outlook for new homes for veterans and others continues to be pretty dark. All over the country, contractors are saying that it's just not worth struggling against delays, black markets, and FHA ceiling prices. Many contractors are quitting or planning to quit as soon as they complete their present commitments. Newsweek has just questioned more than 90 builders in 27 cities to find the reasons for this national dilemma. Here's what it found. First, of course, the builder's selling price was originally fixed by the FHA, which based the costs on OPA prices for materials prevailing at the time. Second, more often than not, the contractor found he could not obtain the materials at those prices when he needed them. So the contractor had two choices. He could buy on the black market at greatly increased costs, or he could just wait. But waiting for legal materials was costly too, particularly when the normal two-month building time ran into 6 months, or perhaps even longer. Finally, most contractors feared that the FHA would at best give them only part of the price relief they insist they need. And so, because they are taking a licking both ways, from the black market and from delays, about half the contractors are throwing up their hands in despair. All builders, large and small, agreed in this survey that delays are crippling the industry. All over the country, foundation holes gape, and the wind whistles through bare skeleton frames, while contractors search for the common lumber, the oak flooring, the soil pipe, the plumbing fixtures, the doors, even the nails that are needed to continue the work. For instance, in Portland, Maine, 141 houses were started this year, and only 11 were completed. In Chicago, one builder finished one house out of 16 that he started. Another builder finished only 7 out of 80. About half of the homes for which builders obtained permits were never even started because of the lack of materials. The survey confirmed that black market prices, incidentally, are skyrocketing. Such bottleneck materials as oak flooring, siding, windows, and doors are selling on the black market for 2 to 4 times OPA ceilings and for as much as 6 times the pre-war price. The net result is that only a small fraction of the American homes that have been definitely planned are actually being built and completed. Now, I should like to repeat that these opinions are not the opinions of Newsweek. We simply report the replies of contractors and home builders. Now, some will say that ceilings should be removed. Others will say they should be more strictly enforced by a stronger OPA. Whatever the answer to that, the fact today is that the morale of the American home building industry is at an all-time low.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. In a period in which the Congress of the United States was being faced with the making of the most critical decisions in its entire history, The National Hour last March presented this scene.
Bill, just say the word and you're as good as in Congress right now. There isn't another man could draw the vote in this district like you.
Sorry, Tom. The answer's still no.
Yeah, but look, fella, this isn't just politics. You're a good man. You know the score. You know the things we need. You'd really give us service.
Sure, Tom. I'd do a good job. I know that.
Well, then why not?
I can't afford to sit in Congress. It's taken me a long time to build up my business here. I have a house and a wife and two kids. I just can't pull out and go. Yeah,
but you'd be getting $10,000 a year in some of your expenses.
Tom, my uncle was in Congress for 10 years. It cost him about $6,000 out of his own pocket. And he wasn't a high liver either.
I sure wish there was some way you could work this out.
So do I. I'm sorry, but the answer stays no.
That scene was part of a broadcast devoted to a then-pending plan for the reorganization and strengthening of Congress. The Joint Committee studying this legislation recommended the suggested points of change. As ultimately passed by Congress, many of the most significant points were incorporated in the reorganization bill.
Congress literally surprised itself when it passed that bill. The bill raised congressional income from $10,000 a year to $15,000, $2,500 of it free from taxes. But much more important, the bill cut the number of committees in both House and Senate to less than half what it had been. Some of the most influential committees in Congress were abolished. This means that the chairman of each of these committees loses much influence, to say nothing of extra clerks, special allowances for stationery, and numerous other benefits. Already, these deposed chairmen have started a move to restore the abolished committees, which would take the heart right out of the program to streamline Congress.
In our year of investigation of the political and social and economic currents in this country and in the world, we examined the forces of inflation, the building of a peace structure for the world. We investigated air power and the problems of veterans in colleges. But there was, and there is, one subject that precedes all others, one that came into being last year and overshadows all others. It was only during the past year that it came to our knowledge. Already it has posed to the world the central problem of the century.
On December 9th, in our Washington studio, an Army colonel stood directly before a small but sensitive special recording instrument. In his hand, he held a slug of very heavy ore. Then the instrument and the ore were moved toward the microphone, and the radio audience heard... For the first time on the air, the sound generated by uranium. The sound of the most powerful energy yet discovered by man. The radioactive sound of atomic force.
From Hiroshima, Nagasaki, from New Mexico and Bikini, we received our lessons in atomic power. Shudderingly, we learned of atomic power as a blinding, searing, lingering destroyer. We learned by way of radio and newsreels and newspapers. We learned by way of a report which occupied an entire issue of a national magazine, a story by John Hersey in the New Yorker magazine of six who survived in Hiroshima. We read the story, and we knew that here, but for the grace of lasting peace, go we in the future.
Now that the theory of atomic power had become stark fact, the National Hour asked the scientists about atomic power for the uses of peace. Although many of the answers were still blanketed by security regulations, we were able, for the first time on the air, to indicate the uses of controlled atomic power as a source of heat and energy for transportation and manufacture. And we learned of its revolutionary implications in many departments of medicine.
It was just 2 weeks ago that one phase of our forecast received official confirmation. A group of scientists submitted a report to Bernard Baruch, United States Representative on the UN Atomic Energy Commission. The gist of that report was...
It is now possible to build an atomic power plant that would produce electrical energy at an operating cost only 26% higher than that of a comparable plant using coal.
The nuclear power plant might aid in the industrial development of isolated parts of the world where the cost of oil, gas, or coal is prohibitive, and where a suitable supply of water is unavailable.
It seems probable that nuclear power will find favorable industrial application if obstacles are not placed in the path of its development.
Atomic power is a thunderous threat, an overwhelming promise, and a terrifying responsibility. For this nation especially, the responsibility is great. The nature of this responsibility was pointed out in the current issue of the magazine Air Affairs. The writer of the article was Professor Harold C. Urey of the University of Chicago, Nobel Prize winner in chemistry and Manhattan District Director of Research for the separation of U-235 during the development of the atomic bomb. He said,
either the United States secures an adequate international control which will prevent all countries of the world from producing atomic weapons, which may lead on to a complete control of war, or else we begin preparations immediately for the Third World War, in which atom bombs will be used. The atom bomb will result in the complete destruction of the civilized cities of the world.
On the subject of our report to date, Ben, our documentary is ended.
And with this broadcast, NBC's News and Special Events Department brings the National Hour series to a conclusion. In these documentaries, we have attempted to provide factual information concerning the issues which arose in the months that followed the end of the war. We have invited to our National Hour microphone many of the persons involved in trying to settle these issues. And now, this is Robert St. John thanking you for your interest in our efforts and saying goodbye for now.
And this is Robert McCormick in Washington on behalf of the National Hour also saying goodbye.
This has been the National Hour. Broadcast in this series were directed by Jack Hill, with original music written by Leo Kempinski, who also conducted the orchestra. Ed Juris was script editor. The series was produced by the NBC News and Special Events Department under supervision of Ann Schneider. Next week, over most of these stations at this same time, listen in for the doings of the Quiz Kids, those young entertainers who know all the answers, and who next Sunday take their places in the coming season's NBC Parade of Stars. Be sure to tune in. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.